Hello and welcome to Science Spinning, the show with an Irish spin on science with me, Sean Duke, here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Up to now, robotic brains have been very primitive compared to the sophistication and the elegance of the human brain. A robot brain today cannot be trained to perform certain tasks like the way a human brain can learn a new language or musical instrument, for example. But moves are afoot to change that and develop new robotic brains that are more flexible, more power efficient, and are built to mimic the human brain's ability to learn and adapt from its environment. Shortly, we'll be talking about the coming generations of robot brains with Dr. Fergal Morgan. He's director of the Bio-Inspired Electronics and Reconfigurable Computer Research Group at NUI Galway. It appears that modern farming methods have become a threat to the wild plants and insects that inhabit the Irish countryside. That at least is according to new research by ecologists based at Trinity College in Dublin that have shown that the rate of pollination of plants by insects is lower on conventional farms compared to organic farms. A reduction in insect-plant interactions on modern intensively managed farms was found, as well as less species generally than semi-natural grasslands. Well, what does this mean for the future of farming in Ireland and the well-being of wild plants and animals? In the second half of the show, we'll be putting that question to Dr. Jane Stout of the School of Natural Sciences at TCD, who led the research into this area that was published recently in the Journal of Applied Ecology. But first up, we're talking about robotic brains, and to talk about this subject, I'm delighted to welcome Fergal Morgan, researcher in this area at NUI Galway. Welcome, Fergal.
Good afternoon, Sean. Nice to be here.
Okay, so you're an engineer and you're with this group, a very long-winded name, Bio-Inspired Electronics and Reconfigurable Computing Research Group.
That's right.
So, okay, that's an NUI Galway. But essentially, as I understand it, you're trying to mimic the human brain. So maybe, as an engineer, I presume you're an engineer.
I am, indeed.
Yeah. How would you describe, from an engineering point of view, the human brain and its complexity?
Yeah, that's a good starting point. The short term for the research group, by the way, is BERC, without an E and a K, but it actually sounds similar. But I think the long name is probably more descriptive.
Okay, fair enough. B-I-R-C.
B-I-R-C.
Yeah.
I'll start with what a simple brain operation entails. A brain, typically the human brain, has about 100 billion neurons. We all know what billions mean now. It's a huge number, and about 1,000 trillion connections between those neurons.
Okay, neurons, just so people know, these are the cells, essentially, in the brain, the type of cells that inhabit the brain.
That's right, and they have signals coming from other neurons that are little electrical pulses. And the more of these pulses that arrive at a neuron, the more likely that neuron is to fire and to generate another pulse, which in turn to all the thousands of connections to other neurons that it has will send pulses throughout different areas of the brain to do different functions and obviously do all the powerful things that the human brain can do.
So it's an amazing organ, isn't it?
Incredibly complex and impossible to replicate in a machine.
Mm-hmm.
We're only trying to replicate small parts of it, and as the term for the research group states, bio-inspired, it's not bioelectronics, it's bio-inspired electronics.
Sure.
Or biomedical electronics. They're different fields. We are inspired by the brain, and we're trying to look at the architecture of the brain and how it processes data.
Okay.
And try to replicate that in silicon.
Sure. We'll get into that now in a second, but just a general question for you. It seems that engineering is trying to, not just the brain, look at the brain and maybe try and mimic it, but look at nature in general in terms of things like architecture or more energy efficient buildings. Is that kind of a trend in engineering at the moment?
Well, I think so. Interestingly, last Friday, the Taoiseach opened a new engineering building in NUI Galway. It's a 14,000 square metre engineering building. And within that building, it's 12 years in the planning. We have environmental systems to circulate heating. We're acutely aware of the problems of energy conservation. And there's a lot of glass, but it's glass that's glazed in a way which allows the outside environment to heat it it's efficiently designed, and we have to show that and illustrate that as engineers.
Sure.
Yes, they're very important topics.
Because I'm slightly off topic, but I remember reading about, say, ants and, how they build their colonies and that they have this incredible ventilation going through the colony, even in very hot places. So, maybe we can learn a lot from nature.
I imagine so. I'm sure there's some of my colleagues in civil engineering, etc., would have strong theory and opinions on all of that.
Okay, now we get on to what you're doing exactly. So you've described a little bit of the human brain. Now, if we take, for lack of a better description, the robot brain as it exists now, what is it, or what does it involve?
Well, typically, robots are controlled by processors. Processors are incredibly powerful as well. They execute instructions on data that they see from the world. And they do that very, very fast. They execute so many instructions that they can do things really, really quickly. It's all about speed. And the processing of all those instructions is sequential.
Mm-hmm.
An inherent sequential architecture is, by its nature, is slow to a point where the brain, there is so much concurrency in the brain. There are so many of these billions of neurons all doing little bits and pieces. And there are clusters within the brain that do particular functions. It's like having, you know, a lot of worker ants all working together rather than one very powerful core that's doing it single step at a time.
Okay, the line isn't great, but we'll struggle on anyway. But yes, so what kind of things is the robot brain at the moment not good at compared to the human brain?
Well, very much actually. The human brain, I'll just go back to the human brain operation a little bit. It works internally with electrical pulses being communicated between all of these neurons. And the channels between all of these neurons can be strengthened or weakened. And the neurons can fire in turn. The point that they fire at can change, etc. And the connection of all the neurons can change. Mm. And it's all of that adaptability that can build a unique portion of the brain to do a particular task.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all electrical. So the real world has to come into the brain through our vision systems. It transfers what we see into through the optic nerve, etc., into electrical stimulus. And then within the brain, it works as a little electrical pulses. And then those electrical pulses at the output of that, what's a neural network effectively, mm-hmm. are the things that control the motor facilities that we can move an arm based on seeing something and picking it up, etc. So the brain internally does not operate as we see the world. It actually brings everything into an electrical impulse. So we're trying to put that onto silicon, and we have a little neuron in silicon that's very small and very low power. I work very closely with colleagues in University of Ulster in McGee, Dr. Leigh McDade and Dr. Jim Parkin, and up there they've patented a neuron cell, it's an electronic neuron cell, and we connect them together within a silicon chip.
Mm-hmm. So you recreate, it's not obviously a living neuron, it's an electronic neuron.
It's a little analog circuit,
yeah.
Yes. And they're connected together. And within a silicon chip also, there is a limitation in the amount of connections you can have. It's like a road system. Sean, you do not have a road from your house to, you know, West Cork just for you. You have to share that route. Yeah, wouldn't it be great? You have to share that. We have some major veins, say, for example, coming from Galway to Dublin. It's really good. But you have to share the road, and you have to take steps through junctions, etc. So what we've done in the electronic system is put what we call a network on a chip. And the spikes, or the little packets, we call them spikes, pulses going through the electronic chip, are put into like little letters and posted through all of these what we call routers, and they eventually get from the source neuron to the destination neuron.
Okay.
It takes a little bit of time, but it's still within biological timings that it will work.
So are you, in general terms now, are you trying to make the robot brain more flexible, able to make its own decisions then, rather than, you know, taking instruction at every step? Is that what you're...
It is a little bit like that. The architecture of the neural network that we have, because it's mimicking the architecture of the brain, but at a very, very simple and a very, very small scale, we're trying to put thousands of neurons and tens of thousands of connections inside the silicon.
Mm-hmm.
What we do is we train the hardware neural network. It's not a software neural network, it's a piece of hardware. It will hopefully be low power and very small, and we put it into embedded applications that could be, say, remote search and rescue applications in a robot, for example, would have something like this. You can't get at them very easily to change them. Therefore, they need a facility to detect faults within themselves, as the brain does, and it repairs
mm-hmm.
itself. And because it's an array of all of these neurons all interconnected, some are used and some are spare. And if a fault is detected by the controller, then it can actually reconfigure itself.
Is this kind of like the way a human brain, if it has a stroke, it tries to find another pathway to keep operating?
It's incredibly fault tolerant.
Yeah,
a human brain.
Fault tolerant. Yeah.
With the hardware neural network, we have to train that. And the way we train, we use another branch of science or engineering, which is evolving systems. We effectively have a brain that's not configured. Imagine the brain of an infant that has to learn and learn and learn and adapt through trial and error, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And we do this a similar sort of thing with the hardware neural network. We we give it a problem, for example, a little robotics problem, that it should control a robot and not allow the robot to hit the side walls. There are ultrasonic sensors that let it know roughly where, how far it is from walls, etc. And the neural network controls the motors. So the objective is that the robot will move quickly from source to destination and will not hit the walls. And initially, the solutions that we put into this electronic little electronic neural network don't work. It fails. And slowly but surely, after thousands and thousands of different trials, we come up with a unique configuration within that hardware neural network that will allow it to do the task at hand. And we can also have multiple alternative solutions, so that if it fails, it can reconfigure itself with the alternative solution and still do the job as well or almost as well as it would otherwise. So it's a different approach to data processing.
Sure. Now, I'm going to ask you a question that, again, is very general, but a kind of a look into the future. That the first question would be, you know, how is this going to change things in terms of the robots we're going to see in the next 10, 20 years?
Well,
and then the other, after that, you can answer this whole area of artificial intelligence. I mean, is it realistic that at some point in the future, a robot might, you know, become aware that it exists, or is that just science fiction?
It's interesting. I don't know that people talk about this concern as much as we used to. I think we're all very used to the fact that processors just process data, but they do it very smartly, and they're in every device that we conceive. So I don't think it's something that people concern themselves with as much as they used to have. At the moment, the neural network that we have in hardware, we have a prototype that works. We need to make it larger, and we're in the process of trying to put thousands of neurons on a piece of silicon. We're developing technology, and we are seeking applications as a result of having that technology as well. And this is what happens in engineering. You tend to have some people work in applications, some people work in technology, and hopefully they will meet at a very good point. So it's a little bit unclear. But the principle is, if we can make a large enough neural network and hardware, then we can approach the processing performance, power and size criteria that companies like Intel, etc., would aim for. They want their devices to be smaller, they want them to be low power, and they want to have very high performance. And at some stage, maybe we will be able to take over the performance of a processor, but we're nowhere near that.
Okay, now you mentioned, just very quickly, say the search and rescue is an example. That's a robot that's going to do that, is it?
Well, there are robots that do that at the moment, and if we could develop a neural network that was so large that it actually could deal with very complex tasks, then and at low power, then we could have a device that doesn't need to have as strong a battery, that will work much longer in a remote environment, and hopefully will help people to do their job better.
Yeah.
As most electronic devices that we have do, they help society do their job better.
Not take over society, but to help us do better. Yeah.
Well,
okay.
As an engineer, that's what I would like, to contribute something beneficial rather than otherwise.
Okay, we've just run out of time, but thanks very much, Fergal, for coming on and telling us about those developments towards a robotic brain. That's Dr. Fergal Morgan, Director of the Bio-Inspired Electronics and Reconfigurable Computing Research Group NUI Galway. Bye, Fergal.
Thank you very much.
Okay, in science news this week, just a couple of items. Brain scans of infants only a few months old, which show how they're processing sounds, could be used as an indicator of possible future language difficulties in a child. That's according to an article in the upcoming edition of Scientific American magazine. Researchers at Rutgers University in the US used electroencephalograph recording techniques to test how well the infant can process sounds. And as well as picking up potential problems at a very early stage, the researchers are working on developing ways to combat any deficiencies that they find. Now, polar bears, these were in the news recently because polar bears were linked with Ireland as a place where they originated. But in any case, polar bears are having a tough time with climate change as the ice is shrinking. And a polar bear has been tracked making the longest ever recorded swim of 426 miles across open sea off the north coast of Canada. That's the equivalent of swimming from Waterford to Belfast and back. Polar bears are under pressure because of the ice, which is obviously making it imperative that they get to land. And so they're being forced into these very, very long swims. Okay, now we're going to move on and we're going to talk about biodiversity, the Irish countryside, and how Pollination, which is a very important process in the Irish countryside, may be threatened somewhat by modern farming methods. And to talk about this, I'm delighted to welcome to the show Dr. Jane Stout. She's from Trinity College in Dublin. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Sean. How are you?
Not too bad at all. So your study is a very interesting one. Maybe give a summary there for readers in your own words, but it's to do with changes that are happening in the Irish countryside.
That's right, yeah, we were looking at pollinators and pollination services in Irish farmland, and specifically we wanted to look at organic farming and whether we were actually seeing an increase in biodiversity and in the ecosystem services, in this case we measured pollination, in organic farms, because organic farming is always being cited as being ecologically friendly, but we wanted to actually quantify that, and so that's what we did in this study.
Okay, now just a general question then. Pollination and insect and plant diversity, how important are these things to have a healthy countryside?
Pollination, well, it's one of these key ecosystem services. It's very important. It's important economically, so we can put a value on pollination, and there's been recent estimates of over 50 million euro a year to the agriculture industry in Ireland. So pollination provides this measurable economic value. So as well as pollination as being important for crops and agriculture, pollination is really important for wild plants. So 65% of Irish wild plant species need or benefit from interactions with insects. And so as the insects visit the flowers in order to get their food, they accidentally transfer pollen between flowers, and that allows the flower to become fertilized and to produce seeds. So without the insects moving the pollen between the flowers, some of the plants wouldn't be able to set seed, so we get changes in our plant communities. So pollination as an ecological process is very important in wild communities.
Sure, and this is one of the reasons why they were worried about bee populations declining, wasn't it? That's their pollinating ability was crucial.
Absolutely, and there's been a lot of interest over the last few years about bee decline, and that largely came from honeybee declines that were recognised in the United States, and so there was this colony collapse disorder that was recognised. That's not so much of an issue here. There are 101 bee species in Ireland. Most people just think of the honeybee.
Yeah.
The 101 species, and over half of them are in decline, according to the records that we have. And some of those species are endangered, and some have even gone extinct. So there are problems which extend beyond the honeybee, and I think most people think about, when they think about bees, they think about the honeybee, but you need to remember that there are 100 other species in Ireland that are also in decline.
And do you know how long this decline has gone on, or what kind of information do we have? Well, does it coincide with, say, our modern farming practices coming
absolutely,
on?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's very difficult. It's difficult to know, it's difficult to measure decline, because we don't know what was there in the first place, but from the records that we have, we have some good records for bees, and this is where we've got these figures of over half of our species in decline, and we're talking about time frames since 1980, so sort of in the last 30 years, when agriculture would have become much more intensive, much more modernised, much more reliance on chemical inputs.
Yeah, and maybe larger farms
larger, more specialised farms, so less of the sort of small farms and the diversity, farmers, specialising into particular crops or particular production systems now.
Yeah, and that they're under pressure in order to make an income for themselves to get
absolutely
into kind of what they call intensive farming. So
that's in order to actually make some money out of it, yeah.
Okay, so what kind of, apart from the chemicals, are there, what else that we do in modern farming is potentially harmful to the countryside?
A lot of the way that the land is managed, so for example, there's not very much wild land left. A lot of land is very heavily managed, so a lot of trimming of trees, cutting of grass, tidying the place up, if you like, as well as larger fields, so removal of hedgerows, and all those, just the removal of the sort of the natural or the wild bits of the farmland.
Yeah, because you do see hedgerows. I was out in Kildare recently where they're all kind of very neatly cut. But that isn't necessarily good for the plants and animals in the area.
It depends how they're managed and when they're managed. So a lot of hedgerow management would be sensitive to birds, you know, so in terms of bird nesting and providing berries and stuff to birds. But if you only focus on, you know, the benefits for one group, then the likelihood is that you're going to be destroying things for another group of animals.
Sure. Tell us about your study exactly then, that you compared insects on different farms, organic and conventional dairy farms.
Dairy farms, that's right, yeah. So we looked at the insects, we looked at the flowers that the insects were visiting, and we looked at the pollination of a hedgerow species. In fact, this was we looked at pollination of hawthorn. And we looked at the interaction networks between plants and insects, because you don't just get one species of insect visiting a single species of plant. You get several species of insect visiting several species of plant, and you get these interaction networks which have structural properties. So we can examine these networks and see how stable they are, how resilient they are.
Mm.
So what we found really was that the interaction networks on the organic farms were larger than those on the non-organic dairy
farms. More interactions, isn't it?
So there's yeah. more interactions, that's right. And there was, but despite that, despite the organic farms having these larger networks, both the organic and the conventional farms had low levels of overlap. So what this means is that the networks are vulnerable to species loss, because if you have lots of, or you have several species of insect visiting one species of plant, and we lose one of those species of insect, it doesn't matter because we still have all the others that can pollinate the plant. So that's what this sort of resilience and ecological redundancy is. And if we have low resilience or low redundancy, that is, if we lose a species, then the network is more vulnerable, and we might end up with a lack of pollinators for particular plants.
Yeah.
So having small networks is bad news. As far
so
as
if you've got if you've got concerned. A small number of species, then they're mm-hmm. more vulnerable to, say, something coming in and wiping them out, and then you could be left with no pollinator in the area.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Yeah.
And so I'm just curious, organic, just mm-hmm. maybe quickly define that as compared to conventional in your own.
Organic farming, I guess, is where the use of chemicals is very severely limited or even prohibited. So we're talking about chemicals like fertilizers, like pesticides, plant growth hormones, livestock antibiotics, etc., etc. And the organic farming promotes the use of sort of more traditional methods of agriculture.
Sure, sure. But if you have, say, an organic farm and it's right beside a conventional farm, would the, say, the chemicals used in the conventional farm, would they not just leak over into the organic?
They may do, depending on how close they are and what kind of chemicals they are and how they're applied. Yeah, absolutely.
So that could happen. So
could.
Now you do say in a note that I got from you that organic farming, although not the solution in its present form, can benefit diversity, etc. So how could we change organic? Is organic farming the way we should be going in this country, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, personally, I think so. A lot of resistance has been put up against organic farming because the production tends to be lower, and so the prices are higher. But in fact, recent research has shown that you can get equal production from organic methods as you can from conventional methods. And of course, if you're not paying out to, you know, to buy fertilizers, to buy the chemicals that you're applying to the seeds, then it can work out to be economically viable as well. I mean, and in terms of the insects and the flowers, then organic seems to be beneficial. I think one of the issues is that at the moment there are a very low number of organic farms in Ireland, and so they're very sort of patchily distributed. So as you mentioned earlier, most of these organic farms are surrounded by conventional farms.
Yeah, they're isolated. Yeah.
Yeah. So it depends on sort of the animals and plants that are involved, and at what scale they're affected by environment and human activity. So if it's something that's very, if it's a species that's very restricted, has a very small distribution, then organic farming may benefit it. But if it's a species which has a very large, you know, individuals move over a large range, or the population needs a large area in which to exist, then the sort of the small patchy organic farms may not be enough. So I think it really depends on the species that we're looking at and the systems that we're looking at and the extent of organic farming in a sort of a landscape context.
Because I suppose as a supporter of organic farming, the nirvana would be the entire Ireland is one huge organic farm. And
that would be fabulous.
That would
yeah.
be the ideal thing. but as you say, I think a lot of people would buy organic if the prices came down or, you know, even if they were slightly more expensive. But if there's a huge difference in price, they're not going to, you know, maybe they can't afford it.
That's right, absolutely, especially at the moment, you know, and people are watching prices a lot more at the moment, so it is important.
And you're saying that it's, you know, with the reduction in inputs of chemicals and other things, fertilizers, that they could actually do, they could reduce the prices, potentially.
I guess so, yeah. I wouldn't know enough about the economics of it, no.
Okay, well listen, thanks very much for coming on and telling
you're
us about your study and giving us your insights into the countryside, the Irish countryside and what's happening. That's Dr. Jane Stout. She's from the School of Ecological Sciences at Trinity College in Dublin. Thanks, Jane. So that's all we have time for this week, and thanks again for listening, and I hope you all enjoyed the show. If you'd like to find out more about what's happening in the world of science at home or abroad, or to listen to previous Science Spinning shows, then why not go online and visit my blog, also called Science Spinning, at seanduke.com. So until Thursday from 3:30 to 4 p.m. next week, it's bye-bye from me, Sean Duke.